From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now!
Scrambling to find a scapegoat for its disastrous failure in Iraq, the Bush administration is hounding Ahmad Jalabi, whom it had previously promoted as the great white hope of post-Saddam Iraq.
Iraq issues arrest warrants for Ahmad Jalabi and his nephew Salem Jalabi, head of the tribunal trying Saddam Hussein. We'll speak with veteran Middle East journalist Dilip Hero. Then President Bush is questioned by journalists of color at the Unity Conference in Washington, D.C.
The president of Texas A&M, Robert Gates, said that he would not use race in admissions, and then he later said he would not use legacy. If you say it's a matter of merit and not race, shouldn't colleges also get rid of legacy? And because that's not based upon merit, that's based upon if my daddy or my granddaddy went to my college.
Yeah, I thought you were referring to my legacy.
We'll speak with the Chicago Defender reporter who questioned the president. And then finally, Norman Mailer, the Pulitzer Prize-winning writer, on protest and the presidency. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Fierce fighting is continuing for a fifth day in Iraq between backers of Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr and U.S. forces in Najaf. Sadr said today, quote, "I will defend Najaf until my last drop of blood." On Friday, the U.S. military announced it had killed 300 supporters of Sadr in some of the bloodiest clashes since the fall of Baghdad. On Sunday, the unelected Prime Minister Iyad Alawi visited Najaf and called on Sadr to withdraw, but Sadr refused Alawi's request. Meanwhile, in Bakuba, a car bomb today killed 6 Iraqis, injured 16. A 3-judge panel in Iraq yesterday ordered the arrest of former U.S. ally Ahmad Jalabi and his nephew Salem Jalabi. Ahmad Jalabi, close ties to Vice President Dick Cheney and the Pentagon, was charged with counterfeiting old Iraqi dinars. On Sunday, Jalabi spoke to CNN from Tehran, where he said he was on vacation, and said he would return to Iraq to respond to the fraud charges. This is not Jalabi's first run-in with the law. In 1992, he was convicted in Jordan for bank fraud and a scandal that lost the Jordanian government hundreds of millions of dollars. He remains a wanted man in Jordan. His nephew, Salem, has been charged with murder in connection with the assassination of a top official from the finance ministry in Iraq. Salem is heading up Iraq's special tribunal trying former President Saddam Hussein for war crimes. He's also denied the charges against him. Meanwhile, the new unelected government also yesterday reimposed the death penalty for capital crimes, including murder, kidnapping, endangering national security, and distributing drugs. It's not clear if the order will retroactively apply to Saddam Hussein. On Saturday, Prime Minister Alawi ordered Al Jazeera's office in Baghdad shut down for a month. He accused it of being a threat to national security by inciting the Iraqi resistance. The station's Baghdad bureau has been ordered shut before, first by Saddam Hussein in 2002, later by Iraq's governing council. Iraq's interior minister said the closure was intended to give the station a chance to readjust their policy against Iraq. He said, quote, "They've been showing a lot of crimes and criminals on TV, and they transfer a bad picture about Iraq and about Iraqis and encourage criminals to increase their activities. We want to protect our people," he said. The order came a day after Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld discussed Al Jazeera before the Chicago Council on Foreign Relations. He said, quote, "It's been a terribly damaging thing to have what Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya have done to our country in the Middle East. They've persuaded an enormous fraction of the people that we're there as an occupying force, which is a lie," Rumsfeld said. For the first time in U.S. history, international election monitors will come to the country in November to monitor the presidential election. The U.S. State Department has invited the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe to send a team to monitor the elections. The State Department invitation comes after 13 House Democrats requested U.N. election monitors to guard against irregularities and voting rights abuses like those that occurred during the 2000 presidential election. In other election news, independent candidate Ralph Nader has failed to make the ballot in California after failing to gather the needed 153,000 signatures by Friday. Nader's campaign coordinator in California told the Associated Press that the campaign will now try to convince Green Party members in California to dump David Cobb as their nominee and substitute Nader. In Venezuela, Reuters is reporting hundreds of thousands of supporters of Hugo Chavez rallied in Caracas yesterday, 1 week ahead of the August 15th recall vote, which will determine if Chavez remains in office. Pakistani intelligence sources are accusing the Bush administration of undermining Pakistan's fight against al-Qaeda by leaking the name of a recently detained al-Qaeda member to the press while the man was still working as an undercover double agent. The name of computer expert Mohammad Naeem Noor Khan first appeared in the press last week. Unnamed U.S. officials leaked his name to the press in an attempt by the Bush administration to defend the heightened terror threat level. What the U.S. didn't reveal was that Khan had been working undercover to help authorities track al-Qaeda members in Britain and the United States. Once his name appeared in the press, the British police had to hastily round up suspects that had been in contact with Khan. At least five wanted men went on the run as soon as Khan's arrest became public. A security expert at Jane's Defense told Reuters, quote, "The whole thing smacks of either incompetence or worse. You have to ask, what are they doing compromising a deep mole within al-Qaeda when it's so difficult to get these guys in there in the first place?" The expert went on to say, quote, "Running agents within a terrorist organization is the holy grail of intelligence agencies, and to have it blown is a major setback which negates months and years of work, which may be difficult to recover," he said. George Bush may be the first president since Franklin Delano Roosevelt in 1932 to end his term with a higher unemployment rate then he began. This prediction from the New York Times came after the Labor Department reported Friday that only 32,000 jobs were created in July. The total was about 90% lower than the projected 240,000 jobs. Nearly 9 million people have lost employer-backed health insurance over the last 3 years, according to a new study by the Washington-based Center for Studying Health System Change. The overall percentage of the U.S. population without insurance did not rise significantly, but many of the people who lost employer coverage appear to have moved to public coverage under Medicaid and other programs. In Japan, an accident at a nuclear power plant has killed at least 4 people and hospitalized 10 more. Officials say a steam leak occurred at the plant, but they insisted no radiation was leaked. Japan relies on nuclear power for about 30% of its electricity. Israel Radio is reporting Prime Minister General Ariel Sharon has shelved his plans to illegally build more than 1,300 new homes in the West Bank after the plan came under criticism by the Bush administration. And if the country's billionaires could select the president, Bloomberg News is reporting President Bush would win hands down. According to Bloomberg, nearly 4 times as many billionaires have contributed to Bush's candidacy than to Kerry's. Bush has received donations from a total of 131 billionaires, including Bill Gates of Microsoft. John Kerry has received the backing of 31 billionaires. Donald Trump was one of 6 billionaires to give to both campaigns. And finally, Raymond Levasseur has been released from prison after 20 years. He was a founding member of the anti-imperialist United Freedom Front and the Sam Melville Jonathan Jackson group. Levasseur in the Ohio 7 was linked to 22 bombings in the late 1970s and early 1980s, including the offices of South African Airways, Mobil Oil, and Honeywell, as well as many military installations. Advocates for political prisoners have long called for his release. Levasseur is now scheduled to live at a halfway house in May until his formal release on November 4th. This is Democracy Now! War and Peace Report. DemocracyNow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. As we broadcast on more than 240 Pacifica radio stations, NPR stations, public access TV stations, PBS, and on both satellite networks, on Dish Network, Free Speech TV, Channel 9415, and on DirecTV, Channel 375, Link TV. I'm Amy Goodman. An Iraqi judge has issued arrest warrants for former governing council member Ahmed Chalabi and his nephew Salem Chalabi. Ahmed Chalabi had close ties to Vice President Dick Cheney and the Pentagon. He's wanted on counterfeiting charges. The Associated Press quoted the judge as saying Chalabi appeared to have been mixing counterfeit money with other old money and changing it into new dinars in the street. Police found the counterfeit money during a May raid on his house in Baghdad, said the judge. Ahmed Chalabi was once the Pentagon's favored candidate to lead Iraq, but fell from grace amid allegations of links to Iranian hardliners and concerns that he provided faulty intelligence in the run-up to the war. Chalabi spoke to CNN from Tehran yesterday and said he would return to Iraq to respond to the fraud charges. Separately, Ahmed's nephew, Salem, heads up the tribunal trying Saddam Hussein, was named as a suspect in the murder of the director general of the finance ministry, Haitham Fadel. Fadel was shot and killed in May. He'd been preparing a report on reclaiming government-owned real estate. According to a source quoted in the Los Angeles Times, the document concluded that members of the Chalabi family and their political party, the Iraqi National Congress, had illegally seized hundreds of pieces of property after the U.S.-led invasion last year. Both men, who are out of Iraq right now, denied the charges and said that they are politically motivated. We turn now to Dilip Hero, veteran journalist in the Middle East. His trilogy of books on Iraq and Iran are considered the most definitive histories of the war in the Persian Gulf. His latest book is Secrets and Lies, Operation Iraqi Freedom and After. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Dilip.
Yeah, thank you.
It's good to have you with us. So let's talk about these arrest warrants of Ahmed Chalabi and his nephew, Salem, which I believe Salem is in London, where you are.
Yeah, that's true. I think that, you know, this particular warrant is against Ahmed Chalabi. It talks about counterfeit money. Now, this has to do with the changeover of the old Iraqi bank notes, which had Saddam Hussein's picture on it with new notes, and they were exchanged, the old ones were exchanged for the new ones. And at that time, Mr. Ahmad Jalabi was in charge of the finance at the Iraqi Governing Council, and there were two options, either to burn the old banknotes or to bury them. And he suggested, or in fact, he decreed that they should be burnt, and a contract went to one of his buddies. Now, in that transaction, about $12 million were missing. You know, what you would do is that, you know, as an ordinary citizen or an employee of a company, you would take your old notes to the bank, and the bank would give you new notes. And in those transactions, $12 million are missing, and there were about six or seven bank tellers who were supposed to be involved. And it was in the course of that particular scam that a warrant was issued to search the home and the office of Ahmad Jalabi last May. And we are told that in the course of that particular search, counterfeit money was found. Now, the one report that I have read is that this pertains to a few counterfeit dollar bills which were found and which apparently they claim were given to Ahmad Jalabi as some kind of a joke. And so we don't know exactly, you know, what this particular charge against him really means, but we have to look at it at the bigger picture, the political picture, which is that Bush administration knows, everybody knows, the majority of Americans know that the invasion of Iraq has gone wrong, it has failed, and the Bush administration looking for scapegoats. And that's why we had Mr. George Tenet resign. And, of course, then they said that if we got the information wrong on the weapons of mass destruction, it's the fault of Ahmad Jalabi, who, through his Iraqi National Congress, gave us wrong information. So the Jalabi is being made the fall guy. But you see, you have to remember, and anybody who has looked at my book, Secrets and Lies, it isn't Jalabi's fault. It is basically, as we have seen, that Bush, Cheney, and Rumsfeld had made up their mind up front that they are going to invade Iraq, and any information which supported this particular point of view or this particular decision made before actual information or intelligence, they welcome any news which supported this notion, and whether it came from Ahmad Jalabi or even if it came from Mr. Alawi, who was running then Iraqi National Accord. And it was Mr. Alawi who had given the information that Saddam Hussein would be able to arm his missiles or his mortars with WMD in 45 minutes. And that is the big thing which was used by the Blair government in London to shore up support for invading Iraq. That information actually came from Mr. Alawi's outfit called the Iraqi National Accord, INA. Now, the point is that Mr. Bush and his team are looking for scapegoats, and Mr. Jalabi is the one who is being hounded. Not that Mr. Jalabi is by any means an angel. Of course, he is, I have to say, in the habit of pinching other people's money. As you know, that he was prosecuted and tried in absentia because he ran away from Jordan, where he had a bank called a Petra Bank, in 1989, and he was tried in absentia, found guilty of misappropriating money and fraud, and given 22 years of jail sentence with hard labor. So he has that background, but of course all that background was kept in the background when Mr. Jalabi was being promoted as the great white hope of post-Saddam Iraq. And now, of course, things have gone wrong, so Mr. Bush and his team are looking for a scapegoat. So I think we have to bear this political agenda in mind when we're discussing Mr. Chalabi's case.
Dilipir, I also want to ask you about Salem Chalabi and about the closing of Al Jazeera, but we have to break for 60 seconds, and we'll be back with the veteran Middle East journalist. He's based in London. This is Democracy Now! after we finish our conversation with DeLapiro. We'll hear President Bush answering questions from the largest gathering of North American journalists in this country's history, sponsored by the Four Major Journalists of Color organization, questions about legacy admissions versus affirmative action, and his definition of sovereignty. Then we'll hear from Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Norman Mailer. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now! We're talking about the arrest warrants issued for Ahmed Chalabi and his nephew, Salem Chalabi, on different charges. Ahmed Chalabi for counterfeiting money, Salem Chalabi, his nephew, who is head of the tribunal to try Saddam Hussein for murder, allegations that he was involved with the murder of a high-level official in the Iraqi finance ministry in May. DeLapiro, our guest, Middle East journalist, your response to the Salem Chalabi charges?
Yeah, I think that what's happening in this case is that he has, and of course, you know, he's right now in London. But anyway, he has been invited by the Iranians to come to Tehran, and he's agreed to go to Tehran. In fact, I've been to Iran recently, so I know this story. That the Iranians are saying that when it comes to the charges against Saddam Hussein, the one important charge which is missing is that Saddam Hussein invaded Iraq in 1980. You know, and that should be included. And apparently, if Salem Chalabi is going to Tehran, he will discuss that.
Invaded Iran.
Americans like that, you know. And second thing, the Iranians are pointing out that, you know, there are 100,000 victims of the chemical attacks that Saddam Hussein's Iraq mounted against the Iranians in the 1980-88 war, and that should also be included. So I think this will be, again, the political aspect. They don't like Mr. Salem Chalabi to, you know, talk to Iranians and so on. So as far as Al Jazeera is concerned, I in fact heard Ms. Al Jazeera, you know, spokesman explaining that, you know, the two, say, charges against him. One was that you, Al Jazeera, you are saying, describing Mr. Alawi as interim prime minister. So the spokesman said, what's the matter? And that's the official title. He is an interim prime minister. He's not the elected prime minister. And second charge, you know, against Al Jazeera was that you were showing these videos of terrorists and so on and so forth, to which the Al Jazeera man said that we are not the only one. And Al Arabiya and other television companies are showing these videos that were being, you know, put out, and they are going on the website, so it's very easy for anybody to broadcast them. So we are not the only ones to do it. And of course, this goes to show the whole thing about freedom of speech is being squashed, you know, by a government which itself is appointed by occupying power of the United States.
Well, I want to thank you very much, DeLapiro, for joining us. DeLapiro's latest book, Secrets and Lies, Operation Iraqi Freedom and After. This is Democracy Now! As we go now to Washington, D.C., to the conclusion of the Unity Conference, which wrapped up this weekend, the largest conference of journalists in U.S. history. Over 8,000 journalists gathered. The event was organized by the major Journalists of Color organization, National Association of Black Journalists, of Hispanic Journalists, Asian American Journalists Association, and the Native American Journalists Association. At the conference, Unity released the results of a survey it conducted with the University of Maryland. Maryland's Philip Merrill College of Journalism that shows that only 1 in 10 writers, editors, and bureau chiefs in the Washington Daily newspaper press corps are journalists of color. While journalists of color are rarely in a position to question President Bush at one of his rare news conferences, a handful of journalists did have a chance to question him on Friday when the president addressed the Unity Conference. Each organization at the conference selected one journalist to question Bush. We begin with Roland Martin, a columnist for the Chicago Defender newspaper.
Mr. President, Roland Martin.
Tell him what it's about, Martin.
Well, I will. Nationally syndicated columnist with Creator Syndicate and also the editorial consultant for the Chicago Defender, the nation's only daily black newspaper. And I will. And representing the National Association of Black Journalists, the world's largest minority media organization. And the inside joke, a 1991 graduate of Texas A&M University. And Mr. President, before I ask the question, I hope you give our Governor Rick Perry a call. I know you spend a lot of time in D.C., Mr. President, but they're trying to cap the top 10% in Texas, so that may have an impact on those students going to college.
Yeah, but so, I appreciate you recognizing that it's working in the first place.
It is, but the percentage of white students increased as well.
See, sometimes,
but I understand.
Sometimes they talk, sometimes they deliver.
I understand. It's okay. I'm working with the A&M president on that. I also hope that you would take a second round of questions from Texan to Texan so we can ask a second question. If you would do me that favor.
All right, just ask your two questions.
Mr. President, you said that 8 million people in Afghanistan registered to vote, and as you said, exercise their God-given right to vote.
Right.
That may be a right from God, but it's not guaranteed in the U.S. Constitution. In 2000, an estimated 2 million people, half African American, had their votes discounted from Florida to Cook County, Illinois, to other cities. Come on, that cuts into other questions. Are you going to order Attorney General John Ashcroft to send federal election monitors to Florida and other southern states? And in this age of new constitutional amendments, will you endorse a constitutional amendment guaranteeing every American the right to vote in federal elections?
Yeah. First of all, look, I can understand why African Americans in particular, you know, are worried about being able to vote since the vote had been denied for so long in the South in particular. I understand that. And this administration wants everybody to vote. Now, best thing we did was to pass the Helping America Vote Act with over, I think it's $3 billion of help to states and local governments to make sure the voting process is fair. And and it's not just the South, by the way. The voting process needs help all over the country to make sure that everybody's vote counts and everybody vote matter. I understand that, and that's why I was happy to work with Congress to achieve this important piece of legislation. Now, just don't focus on Florida. Now, I'll talk to the governor down there to make sure it works. But it's the whole country that needs. Voter registration files need to be updated. The machines need to work. And that's why there's $3 billion in the budget to help, Roland. And obviously everybody ought to have a vote. And what was your other question?
Should we put it in, should we guarantee it in the Constitution?
I'll consider it. Now, what's your second question?
Well, but you said it should be guaranteed in Iraq. Why not America?
Well, it's not guaranteed in Iraq. People have got to show up to vote in the first place. I mean, this is the thing about democracy is people need to step up and decide to participate in the first place. There's no guarantees people are going to vote. They should be allowed to vote. But the problem we have in our society is too many people choose not to vote. And we have a duty in the political process. And you have a duty as journalists to encourage people to register to vote. To do their duty. I'm not saying I'm saying people are choosing. It's not guaranteed they're going to. That's part of the problem we have in America. Not enough people do vote. And you have a duty on your radio stations, on your TV stations, to encourage people to register to vote. I have a duty to call them out to vote. Of course, I'm going to try to call them out to vote for me.
Roland Martin questioning President Bush at the Unity Conference. He's with the Chicago Defender. He also got to ask the last question of the president.
Mr. President, you said, quote, quotas. You said, quote, quotas are an unfair system for all, unquote, with regards to your opposition to affirmative action.
No. Whoa. With regard to my opposition to quota systems.
To quotas, okay. But I've never heard you speak against legacy. Now, the president of Texas A&M, Robert Gates, said that he would not use race in admissions, and then he later said he would not use legacy. If you say it's a matter of merit and not race, shouldn't colleges also get rid of legacy? And because that's not based upon merit. That's based upon if my daddy or my granddaddy went to my college.
Yeah, I thought you were referring to my legacy.
That's why I allowed you to go ahead and bring it out.
Yeah. Well, in my case, I had to knock on a lot of doors to follow the old man's footsteps. If what you're saying is there going to be special treatment for people? We're going to have a special exception for certain people and a system that's supposed to be fair. I agree. I don't think there ought to be.
So the colleges should get rid of legacy.
Well, I think so. Yeah, I think it ought to be based upon merit, and I think it also be based upon. And I think colleges need to work hard for diversity. No, don't get me wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Don't get me wrong. You said against affirmative action is what you said. You put words in my mouth. What I am for is diversity.
I just read the speech, Mr. President.
What speech?
In terms of when you came out against the Michigan affirmative action policy.
No, I said I was against quotas.
So you support affirmative action, but not quotas.
I support colleges affirmatively taking action to get more minorities in their school.
That's a long headline, Mr. President.
I support diversity. I don't support quotas. I think quotas are wrong. I think quotas are wrong for people.
But
do a lot of people.
But just to be clear, you believe that colleges should not use legacy.
I think colleges ought to use merit in order for people to get in, and I think they ought to use a merit system like the one I put out.
Thank you very much.
Thank you all. Thanks for having me.
President Bush being questioned by Roland Martin of the Chicago Defender. And he joins us now on the telephone from Chicago. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy. How are you?
Are you satisfied with the president's answers?
Excuse me, say it again. I'm sorry.
Are you satisfied with the president's answers?
Somewhat. Obviously, he said that he would consider the constitutional amendment. He certainly answered the legacy question. I think on those two, we got as much as one could expect from the president on a spot moment. I think the critical thing is that you have to continue to press and press and press to ensure that the answers are, the questions are indeed answered. And I thought that was the beauty of the format, and that we were not limited to ask a question and sit back and let him expound on the answer.
Can you talk about the background of legacy and President Bush's own record?
Well, I mean, legacy is very simply individuals who are admitted to colleges and universities based upon the fact that their fathers or grandfathers or grandmothers and mothers attended a particular university. President Bush was an admitted C student in high school who could not get into the University of Texas, yet because his grandfather was Senator Prescott Bush, his father was George Bush, he had an opportunity to be admitted to Yale University. And although I may be a Texas Aggie, and UT is certainly our biggest rivals, I think Yale has a little bit more stringent policy than the University of Texas to get into school. And so the president knew exactly where I was going, and so he came out and said it. Of course, the White House is now trying to spin it by saying that he was trying to follow in his father's footsteps at the White House. But I think an admitted high school student with a C did not have any thoughts of the presidency when his dad was also trying to get Justin to the university, into the U.S. House of Representatives. And so as a result, across this country, at Harvard, at Yale, at Princeton, at the University of Texas, at Texas A&M, and major institutions across this country, individuals are admitted to college who frankly don't have the grades to get into school. And so what has always angered me, and I wrote about this in USA Today last year, after he made the announcement opposing the Michigan Affirmative Action Policy, my problem is individuals across the country, they sit here and they criticize affirmative action, they criticize the use of race in college admissions, yet they don't say a single thing about legacy. You cannot say on one hand, I oppose admissions to universities if you include race. But then, on the other hand, I support legacy. It's like what Colin Powell told the Republicans at their convention in 2000. How can you sit here and oppose welfare to poor people yet you say nothing about corporate welfare? Mm-hmm. It's the same kind of situation.
Well, Roland Martin, I want to thank you for being with us, but you must say that President Bush will give hope to C students, given that that was his average at Yale, and he ended up getting into Harvard Business School.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you. Roland Martin of the Chicago Defender questioning President Bush on Friday in Washington, D.C. After that session, the Reverend Jesse Jackson held a news conference, and among the issues he addressed was the heightened security alert that had been announced by the Department of Homeland Security. This is Reverend Jesse Jackson.
My last point is about this issue of the orange security alert. About that, we must be cautious and skeptical. We must be cautious of an alert because we have been hit before, which means we can be hit. So we should not ever disrespect an alert. Because in Russian roulette, that could be the silver bullet. We must be cautious about being hit. On the other hand, suspicious because three-year-old information comes out the day the Democratic Party convention ends. Cautious because while there is the alert, we're not likely to be hit again by airplanes hitting tall buildings. The weapon of choice for terrorists is not an airplane, it's an AK-47 or an Uzi. So come September, Bush and Ashcroft are willing to allow assault weapons to be unbanned again. They intercepted 7,500 AK-47s coming into the port of Vermont just a few weeks ago. Suppose terrorists had 7,500 AK-47s. Every police chief in America says that is no defense. Suppose on a given day at 20 places at traffic time, 5 o'clock to 7, they had 20 AK-47s and 20 markings and start firing. They would panic the whole nation. We have no defense against that kind of an attack. So why unleash these weapons of imminent and mass destruction? Step two, his tax cut has reduced 23,000 street police and 100,000 fewer police in training. Number three, we are vulnerable not by air as much as we are vulnerable by ports. The last tax cut kept our port security check at 5%. It should be at 20%. If he had just allowed millionaires an $83,000 tax cut, tax benefit, rather than $88,000. For that $5,000, we'd have taken port security up to 20% rather than 5%. We are vulnerable at our ports more than we are in the air. We're vulnerable at the level of street police protecting us in highly volatile or dangerous areas. We are vulnerable at the point of AK-47 Uzis being made again legal in our streets. This is not a position. You can have a gun to protect your house if you think that would protect it, or a gun to shoot rabbits. You don't shoot rabbits with AK-47s. You don't hunt deer with AK-47s or with Uzis. And so we have some burden today upon us to keep demanding, A, that our right to vote is assured and protected. I ask him again, Mr. President, I would like to have a meeting with you. For 3.5 years, he has not met with organized labor one time. It's not just about the NAACP. He's not met with organized labor. Now, a leadership conference on civil rights, 120 organizations, has not met one time with you. Has essentially a closed-door policy at the Department of Justice and the White House. He was uncomfortable with the question of Roland raised because he's not engaged with us in 3.5 years. It's really been the first public meeting with him in 3.5 years. We deserve the right to meet with the President and the Department of Justice. We do not have that today. I would hope that as you keep demanding your place, one product of the 84 campaign was for the first time people like Gwen Ifill and Sylvester Monroe and Jack White, these African-American journalists, Native Americans, Latinos, was on the presidential plane. And all of them couldn't be on my plane, so they ended up being on other planes. And they began to grow in the process. But now when I look at the CNN poster with the features from Mr. Cooper to Mr. King to Ms. Woodruff to some, all these are white people. Now look at the roundup, Wolf Blitzer and Larry King and so forth. All these are white people. Now MSNBC from Katie Couric to whomever, we deserve not just to be reporters, but to be interpreters of news. Not just report it and then somebody else edit it. We deserve to write. Why are you so important, ultimately? Where's your power? If I were buying my wife a very expensive diamond ring, and she was delighted and happy, and I was happy and broke, but she had the ring. Someone would say, in all of your ecstasy and joy, please get this ring, insure it, because you might lose it or it may be stolen. Now, I pay you $50,000, and here is my receipt. Some guy downtown would say, I see a flaw. It's worth $25,000. Here's my receipt. It would be insured at the appraised value. Or, it's a rare cut. Where'd you get this ring from? It's worth $100,000. Power is in the eye of the appraiser. So on a given day, those who appraise his speech will have the power to determine its worth in the public. And our mission is for you, when they do those roundup shows at night, for you to be interpreters and appraisers, not just reporters. Thank you very much.
And that was the Reverend Jesse Jackson speaking at the Unity Convention this past weekend. You are listening to Viewing Democracy Now!, the largest public media collaboration in this country. Tomorrow, we're going to look at the presidential candidates and Native America. Next up, after the break, Norman Mailer. Stay with us.
From the Indians, welcome to pilgrims, and to the buffaloes, once rule a plain. Like the vultures circling beneath the dark clouds, looking for the rain. Looking for the rain. Just like the cities that stagger on the coastline, in a nation I just can't stand much more. Like the forest buried beneath the highway, never had a chance to grow. Never had a chance.
Gil Scott Heron, Winter in America. This is Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. At the President Bush speech and questioning at the Unity Conference, he was interrupted by a protester who had come into the large convention center who shouted, shame, shame. On the eve of the Democratic National Convention 2 weeks ago, I had a chance to interview one of the country's best-known literary figures, Norman Mailer, at a benefit for WOMR, which is Outermost Radio in Provincetown, Massachusetts. Norman Mailer lives in Provincetown. Over the past half century, he's written 39 books, won 2 Pulitzer Prizes, and co-founded the Village Voice. 36 years ago, Norman Mailer wrote one of the definitive accounts of the historic 1968 conventions in Chicago and Miami. The book was called Miami and the Siege of Chicago. He also wrote Armies of the Night, which chronicled the 1967 march on the Pentagon protesting the Vietnam War. I asked Norman Mailer about his thoughts on this lead up to the November election.
The people who hate Bush, like myself, are heating up one end of the stick. We're getting it red hot, but we're not reaching the middle. at all. Now, my feeling is that if I were a Republican, I would know how to handle that rage. I would encourage it and encourage it and encourage it. And I'd have my little people in with all the activists to create some awful, awful scenes while the conventions are on. Because you keep talking about how awful the media is in terms of its limitations. It cuts off both ends of every discussion. The media is that way for a reason, which is this country, the center of this country, the corporations, are determined to control the thing. And my argument is that unless Kerry's elected, and God knows Kerry is not Jesus Christ, nor is he Joan of Arc. He's a man slightly to the left of the middle who will play with the corporations and work with them. But nonetheless, he will have to have more of an open ear to us than the Bushies. And so our first need at this point is not to keep heating one end of the stick. It's to reach the middle. It's to reach those conservatives who don't know what we're talking about. And the immediate need is to defeat Bush. But to do that, we have to reach the middle. And the only way we can reach the middle at this late date is that if we're extraordinarily peaceful in our demonstrations before the election, because the media are just waiting there like coiled springs, hoping that there'll be a few maniacs who'll cut loose. Maybe there'll be a few people who'll know what to do with the American flag as far as the Republicans are concerned. And that is, the Republicans are hoping that we'll make assholes of ourselves. They're counting on that. And I would like to see the word go out to all the activists that we are walking into a tremendous trap. Why ever did the Republicans choose New York? Keep asking yourself that question. Leon Trotsky once said, there are certain questions that answer themselves by being asked. And that one, you ask yourself, you'll have the answer. Why did the Republicans choose New York? Let's not walk into their trap.
Now, well, why don't we continue in that vein? And you wrote an incredible work, Miami and the Siege of Chicago, about what happened in 1968. Why don't you talk about the Siege of Chicago and relate it to what you're talking about today?
Well, there you had, in a funny way, what you had was a reverse media, because the media covered the massacre on Michigan Boulevard. Most of you, I'm sure, know all about it. For those of you who don't, there was a huge march of demonstrators, an essentially peaceful march, that went up Michigan Boulevard. And at a given moment, given the order by Mayor Daley, then, not the present, Richard Daley, but his father, the police surged into the marchers and beat them up with canes. And it was all on television. It was extraordinary television. One of the incredible moments of network television. And everyone was shocked down to the core. The Cronkites, the Rathers, whoever was there then, I don't even remember, they all were profoundly shocked. And it looked, at the moment, it looked like how awful the Republicans are going to pay for this. Quite the contrary. The Republicans won. Because out there in the core of America, the thing we have to recognize is the injustices you're talking about in the media, which have rankled me for so many years I can't even talk about it, are not going to be overcome by our talking. They're going to be overcome by our acquiring bits of power more and more. I'd even argue with you that the New York Times, bad as it is today, is far better than it was 50 years ago. 50 years ago, it wasn't even written well. And the point is that to overcome, to overtake this incredible centrality of the corporation. We've got to learn guile. We've got to learn an understanding of the enemy. We've got to devote our lives to it. Not all of our lives. None of us will do that, I hope. But we have to devote a good part of our lives to recognizing that we're not going to win this war by being funnier than the Republicans. The Democrats and the left have been incredibly more funny than the Republicans for 50 years. I said this in Wellfleet last year. We've been laughing at them for 50 years, and we're further back now than when we began. The way to do it is to acquire power. And people in the middle of America are terrified of change. Very often they have bad conscience. The bad conscience comes because, to the degree that they're good Christians, which must be half of the country, they feel that they're a little too greedy to be a good Christian, and it bothers them, which is why we keep getting this brainwashing all the time, which is immensely more successful than the brainwashing that went on in the Soviet Union. That was crude. The kids saw through it. They hated it. Now the brainwashing is immensely sensitive, subtle, clever. You pointed it out all over the place what they do. I was agreeing with you every step of the way, but at the same time I kept saying, it can never be enough because we're talking to ourselves. We've got to reach into that middle. And I would just say the first step is to get Kerry elected, whatever faults he has. Once he's elected, we will have more of a voice. We're not going to have the voice. The corporation will still have the voice. But it could be the beginning of a very long march back toward at least the center of the power we need. And I'm slightly ahead, and I'm going to quit. You go.
What do you think of the role of protest? I mean, you have extensively written about it. You won the Pulitzer Prize for your book.
I'm all for protest when there's not. I'll give you an answer in one sentence. I'm all for protest when an election's not coming up. Because protest can have a huge effect, slowly, steadily, not immediately. Almost immediately, the media, particularly in America, does its best to, generally speaking, to put protest down. But over a long haul, the March on the Pentagon ended up being a success. I've said this many times, but what Lyndon Johnson saw was that 50,000 middle-class people, middle-aged and young and a few old, came to Washington, paid their way to get to Washington with the prospect of being hit over the head with a club. And Lyndon Johnson was a very canny man. He knew there was one thing about middle-class people. They didn't like getting hit over the head with a club. And if they were going to spend their money to come to Washington to protest, he was sick. Because he knew if he paid the way of all the people who would come to support his war in Vietnam, he'd be lucky to get 5,000 people. So 50,000 to come this way in all fear and all determination, then there probably were somewhere between 5 million and 50 million behind them, and he didn't want to find out. It took something away from him. He brought in Clark Clifford at one point to ask him for an honest appraisal of the war in Vietnam. And Clifford said, it's a loser. Clifford was respected by Johnson because he was objective. He said, you're not going to win this war. You can't. And I think that led to, now we get into all the complications of history. It's never clean. So Johnson stepped down. Nixon came in. Nixon knew his advantage was to keep the war going for 4 years, to get reelected, et cetera, et cetera. Here we get into all the tangles. I'm saying we have to enter the land of the tangles.
Mm-hmm. Well, at the Republican convention, there are plans for a massive march of something like 250,000. Perhaps there'll be more.
I hope there's 500,000. 500,000. At my age, it gets harder to count. But the problem may well be whether they can get permission. With Bloomberg and Pataki there.
They've now gotten permission, but it's to march on the West Side Highway, which is quite far from where the convention is taking place.
It's a long walk from the Lower East Side, where it all started.
And so you approve of this protest?
Well, I approve of protests of all sorts, depending on their position, their timing. I never approve of a protest that I think is a folly. So my point is, this protest, yes, I approve if it's peaceful. If the leaders of the activists get across the notion that it'll be a disaster if it's a bad, if there's too much rioting, and indeed suspect the people who are rioting. They may not be, they might be on another payroll altogether.
Now, you have always called yourself a third-party man. What do you think about Ralph Nader?
I met him in Chicago the other day, about a month ago. He's the nicest, most decent politician I've ever met, but I do think he's doing what I'm afraid the left and the left of center is going to do on this one, is they're going to end up handing it to Bush before it's all over. And my feeling is this, that if Bush gets it, everything we do is restricted to Provincetown and San Francisco and places like that. That, in other words, if we want to really have a say in what's going on in our country and in the world, we absolutely, absolutely have to get Kerry elected. Amy, let me finish one thought, which is we've got to curb our rage for the next 4 months. Not put it away forever. Far from it. Far from it. This rage is legitimate. But I think it's going to be much more powerful after Kerry's in. And the reverse is true if he isn't.
When you talk about curbing the rage, do you see a difference between now and 1968 in terms of how many people across the political spectrum are angry? I mean, you have now military families who are rising up, 1,000 dead U.S. servicemen.
I know what you want to say.
Women.
Let me interrupt because I really got to leave. I really got to leave. There's more rage across the spectrum now. But I keep repeating there's a profound conservatism in American life. There's a terror of excess in the average middle American. And if they're on, right now the election is so close that if the rage erupts and does silly and stupid things before the election, it's going to lose the election. Now, I could be dead wrong. I'm wrong half the time.
But I mean the conservatives that are mad. That's what I'm asking, if you see a difference between now and 1968 in terms of the number of conservatives who are mad.
Absolutely. Yes.
Those are
the ones I want to reach.
Yeah, and how do you suggest reaching them?
Moderation. That's what they live for. People are conservative because they're moderate.
If the media covers nothing but a protest that becomes violent, if they ice out so much dissent, how do you reach?
My point is they can ice it out for a period. They can't keep icing it out. We are a force of outrage. I'm just saying this force, I'm just hoping that this force waits 4 months to express itself and then has its jubilee.
Norman Mailer, Pulitzer Prize-winning writer, speaking 2 weeks ago in Provincetown, Massachusetts at Provincetown Town Hall. And that does it for today's program. Tomorrow night, on Tuesday night, I'll be at the Stephen Wise Free Synagogue at 8 o'clock with Jim Hightower and others. Next Wednesday night, August 18th, with Arundhati Roy, David Barsamian, and Boots Riley at the Berkeley Community Theater, a fundraiser for KPFA and Pacifica. On August 19th in Denver at the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Cherry Creek. Eureka, California, benefit for KMUD, KMUD, and KHSU at the Eureka Municipal Auditorium on August 21st in Hopland, on August 22nd, Grass Valley, on August 22nd, and on August 23rd in Sacramento. Very much looking forward to seeing folks there. Democracy Now! Is produced by Sharif Abdelkaddous. Happy birthday, Sharif. Also, Mike Burke, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, John Hamilton, Jeremy Scahill, and Nell Geiser. Special thanks to Dennis Moynihan, Mike DeFilippo, our engineer. Our director is Uri Galed, Angela Alston, our technical director. Our website, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.